But with the worldwide peace demonstrations coming up this weekend, I thought I'd want to open by asking you what are the relations between, both organizational and agenda-wise, between the global justice movement and the peace or anti-war movement?
Well, I think that they are separate and they are also the same. For people who care about justice, caring about peace is almost the same thing. I mean, you can't separate the two things. So although you do not see, it will not happen that 50 Years Is Enough Network becomes a peace organization, certainly the work that we do is all related to that. Poverty, oppression, injustice, indignities are very much about disturbing the peace. And so as we work and fight for justice on all these different France, we are also struggling for peace, and so we do not see ourselves as separate, nor do we see ourselves as the same, because certainly there are differences. And so at this time, I'm driving up to New York tomorrow. I'm planning to be in New York at the March for Peace, and I think that it is true of very many people that we work with, that they're organizing and they're part of the coalitions, maybe not taking the lead, but they're part of the coalitions that organizing for peace and to stop the war.
Right after September 11th, the World Bank was trying to enhance its own role in the world and was very aggressively drawing a connection between terrorism and poverty. How did you react to that line? And I think they're still peddling that line. How do you react to that?
Well, let me say this. I'm not an analyst, and I have never claimed to be. But I think it's this, poverty breeds terrorism is the shoddiest kind of analysis I have heard in a long time. And really, both the Bush administration and the World Bank and everyone who was making that analysis was, ought to be ashamed of themselves. And they really, it's about, criminalizing poor people yet again. When, just on the facts alone, most poor people are not, are not in flight school learning how to fly. Most poor people don't have thousands of dollars available to them. Most poor people work very hard, long, long, hard days. We hear a lot about a billion point two who live on less than a dollar a day. They're not trying to figure out how to fly planes. They're trying to figure out how to feed their kids, how to provide for the healthcare of their children, how to house them, how to clothe them, how to educate them. They are not planning. They are not planning to fly planes into buildings. And if they were, we would be living in a world that was hell on earth, because there are lots and lots of poor people who have many reasons to be angry at their governments, to be angry at the World Bank and the IMF, to be angry at the suffering that they endure as they have the rug grabbed from under them time and time again as they try to, to live lives of dignity, to work in conditions where they're not being physically abused, where they're not being exploited. And really the majority of people, poor people around the world are not terrorists, and it was a mistake and really insulting to have the World Bank say fighting poverty is fighting terrorism, perhaps in their minds, but there is something about that. But really the acts on September 11th, the acts we have seen in Bali, the acts we saw in Mombasa last November, and before that on an August morning in 1998 in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, were not the acts of poor people who felt anger in the way that people feel anger and helplessness as they resist and they try to survive in very, very hard conditions. Those were the acts of terrorists, and it's unfair, it is unjust to try and equate those people who commit these acts with poor people who are really just struggling and fighting for their own dignity.
Now let's talk a bit about how we might make the world a better place and what that might look like. When I was speaking with Walden Bellow the other day, who we heard from earlier in the show, that he argued that it's almost a prerequisite for anything, for any improvement in the state of the world, to get rid of these international institutions, the World Bank, IMF, WTO, and then much experimentation, at least, could follow from there. Do you agree with that point of view?
Well, we hear a lot about democracy. We hear a lot about freedom. But when you look at how these institutions operate, just on the voting structure alone, they're not very democratic. That's for one. You know, you have the United States having 17.8% of the vote, while 54 African countries have 2.4% of the vote, and so you have a situation where, you know, the United States then prides itself on being a representative democracy, where members of Congress are, you know, the districts are drawn based on population and representation. But we don't see that kind of principle being upheld within these institutions. But even when you move away from sort of the voting structure of the bank and the fund, and look at how they make decisions, the so-called Washington consensus, it's about people sitting in Washington, D.C., not far from, well, actually quite far from my office these days, but not too far away from my office, certainly closer than for people who are living in, you know, in the Sahel region of Africa, or living in the hills of Haiti, or in Argentina and other places. You have people here in Washington making decisions, life and death decisions, about the lives of people around the world. I don't think that there could be anything more undemocratic. I don't think that there's anything about freedom when countries are not given the right to self-determine and to have the autonomy to decide that this is the path of development and economic development that they're going to follow. So much so that when a Lula gets elected in Brazil, or the new president in my home country, Kenya, Lula said, "My task, you know, I hope I will consider myself a success if every Brazilian has the ability to have 3 meals a day." And you have the Kenyan president saying, "From now on, in my administration, every child who wants to have primary education is free to do so." And so you have 15-year-olds and 13-year-olds and 17-year-olds showing up for first grade saying, "I want to learn." That when those kinds of decisions or announcements are made by presidents in Brazil or in Kenya, it becomes big news, because they are saying, we are charting a path, a different path, and a self-determined path for ourselves. These institutions are anti-democratic. They are outdated. They are dinosaurs. They are outdated. They were created at a time in 1944. There was both the victors of after World War II, but also many of the colonial powers. They sat and designed a program that would govern, and has continued for almost 60 years now. Next year will be 60 years. Have continued to govern the lives and chart the path of development for people in dozens and dozens of countries around the world. We need to look at this, and I would agree with Walden Bellow that these are dinosaurs. They need to go. They don't know how to adapt. When you look at the ways in which they quote-unquote reform, it's about adapting our language, not living out the values or the ideas spelled out. It's, you know, changing structure adjustment programs, which are about privatization and limiting government support for the most needy in communities around the world and in countries around the world. They take the tenets of structure adjustment programs, because they now know people have realized what it's about, and then they now call it poverty reduction. And so that's what they call reform. And we are saying that's not enough. When they take their response to the demand for debt cancellation is the highly indebted poor country debt relief initiative that says that still requires countries to adhere to 3 years of structural adjustment programs. They have proven in their many, many attempts to reinvent themselves, to recommit themselves to their mission, in the case of the World Bank, of poverty alleviation, that they are not capable of that. And it is time that the best minds around the world come together and figure out how we continue to have, if we continue to have institutions, multilateral institutions, that have a mandate to carry out, that really serves the interest of people who need them to be served, not of corporations. You have the, you know, we now have the World Bank having this private sector development strategy that is really about privatizing everything and handing over services from education to healthcare to road building to immunization programs to multinational corporations that are able to pay up front, to put the money up front. And it's the kind of that's the kind of development that even the new Millennium Challenge account that the Bush administration is talking about. It's about handing weakening governments around the world and handing power and control to multinational corporations. If the World Bank is part of such a strategy, then we know that their mandate is not only violated, but their utility is no longer the useful role that they may have played in the past, and it has been very limited. They have not lived up to their mandate. It's no longer possible to have these institutions playing the kind of role that they have been playing.
Would you be in favor of better forms of new international institutions, or just have the whole idea of international institutions pretty much scrapped and let countries and regions just go their own way?
I think that you could have both. You could have regional institutions where, and you see that happening time and time again, where there are regional economic blocks. You know, certainly the European Union is a good example of that. And you see that happening in many places. But one of the problems that has happened, that continues to happen, is both the European Union and the United States continue to undermine and weaken regional blocks that are trying to really deal both with economic and sometimes political issues within the region. So you have the United States proposing an FTA, the Free Trade Areas of the Americas, and when issues are raised about protectionism by the U.S., about subsidies that the U.S. government provides to its farmers and to its corporations, what do they do? Instead of dealing with that issue, even as they claim a great deal of the time to be free traders, which in fact, you know, if I understand what free trade is about, I don't support it, but well, my understanding of it that this is a, you know, subsidies and tariffs and all of those are a violation of free trade. But what you see them doing, instead of saying, okay, you caught us with, you know, you're right that this is not really within the tenets of the proposal for a free trade area of the Americas, what they have done is that the United States and the European Union, what they keep doing now is trying to undermine that by signing bilateral agreements with different countries. And so when you have, you know, instead of dealing, you know, sort of with Argentina or Brazil, which they can deal with on an almost, not quite, but an almost equal footing, they begin to take off the weaker economies, the Nicaraguas, the Costa Ricas, the Honduras, and the Guatemalas. And then by the time they get to the free trade area of the Americas, that deal has been kind of made already. So the regional bodies that are trying to deal with these issues are really important. In fact, at the World Social Forum, one of the things that President Lula of Brazil talked about is that as he looks at both the FTA and the and other economic issues in the region, that he wants to strengthen the regional economic bloc, Mercosur, and then with a strong Mercosur, they can go and negotiate with the U.S. and with Canada and about the free trade area of the Americas. And I think that it would then we would see a very different FTA, perhaps, and or even see the FTA deal fall apart. And so we can have regional institutions, and we can also have international institutions. And I'm an internationalist, and I believe that we need international institutions, but we can't have international institutions. And the reason why the current international institutions have failed is that within those institutions, there is no real democracy, there is no transparency, there is no accountability. So you have the World Bank, you have the IMF, you have the Inter-American Development Bank, you have even the African Development Bank, all of them, and the Asian Development Bank, making decisions about, again, sitting far away and making decisions about communities, whether it's projects or policies, that where they are not accountable to the people who are affected by those institutions. And so we need to have institutions, international institutions, that are really accountable to to the communities and to the countries where they're making where they're making decisions and they're making policy. And so different kinds of institutions are necessary, and certainly multilateral institutions. And as I said before, I think that the bank and the fund have proven that they cannot reform themselves. And so we need new institutions, better institutions, accountable and transparent institutions.
So let's conclude by just imagining, you know, we have this world where there have better institutions. The World Bank and the IMF have been dismantled or completely transformed. What kinds of policies would you like to see the poor countries of the world pursuing?
I would like to see, you know, I think I've talked with you before, certainly on WBAI, I've talked about when you look at, and it's kind of a weird way to answer the question, but let's go back to the United States and the aftermath of September 11th and the economic downturn of September 11th and the actions and the policies that were taken by the Bush administration, really under very difficult conditions, trying to respond to a crisis like no one else, no country had ever known. And I think it's very telling, and it's a real education for people and for governments around the world. We saw the United States very quickly around the anthrax scare say, the United States actually and Canada say, we have a public health crisis and a threat here, and at this time the U.S. government is not going to honor Bayer's patent for Cipro because we have this crisis and we need to meet the needs of our communities. And so they made that declaration, and I am sure that the U.S. government would then have been able to afford to provide Cipro for every person who needed it in the United States. When you look at the HIV/AIDS crisis and what is happening in Africa, where governments have been fighting, not even to ignore the patents, but to buy affordable generics, where the price, if you buy from Pfizer and Merck and GlaxoSmithKline, the price is between $10,000 and $15,000 per patient per year. And when you buy generics from Thailand and India and Brazil, that price goes as low as $290 per patient per year. That kind of a response is what should be the right and the prerogative of every government, to provide for the needs of its people, to fight in the best way possible to protect the health of its populations and its citizens. You look at so that's one example. The other example is the airline bailout, and bear in mind that for each of all the things that the United States government, the Bush administration did, not only are they against what the Bank and the Fund advise African governments and Latin American governments and Caribbean and Asian governments to do, and Eastern European governments, which have these institutions making policy. So the airline industry suffered a great deal. People were scared of flying. People did not want to get on planes for obvious reasons. And the Bush administration put out a $15 billion airline bailout. Now, when you look at the Asian financial crisis, when you look at Argentina, sectors that suffered because of the financial crisis in those countries were not protected. In fact, the IMF forbade countries, even when they pulled together in Asia, they pulled together a $120 billion bailout for Thailand, South Korea, and Indonesia. The bailout was to bail out Wall Street firms, investment bankers and banks, and other people and other institutions that had made really bad decisions. South Korean, Indonesian, Thai industries and sectors, Thai banks and investment firms were excluded. So again, the bailout as a way to save a sector, and we can argue about whether it did that, given that thousands of people were still laid off, airline workers were still laid off. Is another example. The other example, and I'll move along very quickly, was Greenspan several times, lowering interest rates in the United States to help the economy, jumpstart the economy. Argentina, under the ongoing, more than a year long now, ongoing crisis, has been forbidden by the IMF from lowering interest rates. We saw deficit spending come into style. And, you know, right in May of 2000, East Timor became the newest country, the newest independent country, and the bank was putting the squeeze on East Timor, saying, you know, yeah, we know in the future you're going to have these revenues from oil, but you cannot do deficit spending now, and actually putting East Timor into the situation where they were going to start off with a debt. And we have other examples, the steel tariffs, 30% steel tariffs on imported steel in the United States. So, for a world, for a different world, for a better world, it's a world where governments have the autonomy, have the ability to self-determine what makes sense and what is the best course of best path to follow to provide both the basic and immediate needs of their population, their citizens, but also for the long term. And when you talk to people in country after country, they believe and they know and they have seen the difference that comes from being able to feed their children, provide for their health care. They are more productive. They are able to invest better in their communities and in the long term, instead of the model that we have now, which is an export-oriented model where people are growing flowers and coffee and cotton and tea. And at the same time, you have the United States subsidizing cotton farmers in the U.S. and wiping out cotton farmers in Mali. Soon enough, you will have a generation of Malian farmers who have invested everything, who are going to be devastated and have their productive capacity completely decimated. So the kind of world that I imagine, you know, some people may say, well, too micro and not possible. It's a world where governments are able to get the tools and the opportunity to provide and to meet the needs of their population. It is how, time and time again, the United States has done. And, you know, if you look at what happened after the crash of 29, you know, after World War II, the ways in which institutions, public works projects were put in place to help both keep the economy going and provide employment for people. And really, for any time I've ever talked to people, poor people, working people around the world, and I bet it's the experience of your listeners, even they themselves who are working poor and poor people and working people, is that they're not looking for handouts. They're not looking for charity. They're looking for justice. They're looking for a chance to succeed, because they work very hard, and to succeed and to have lives and jobs with dignity. And that's really all people want. But they can't have that if the bottom line for multinational corporations are being guarded and being put before their lives and their dignity, whether by the corporations themselves, whether by governments, whether by international financial institutions. There's a great deal of hope, and I had the opportunity and the privilege to experience it about 3 weeks ago in a place called Porto Alegre, Brazil, where people are working together, they are strategizing, they are learning from each other. And hope is a very powerful thing. I also had the opportunity to experience it in late December 2002 in my home country, Kenya, as people went to elections. And for the first time in 24 years, they were able to actually have their wishes at the ballot honored by having a new president elected instead of having a president rigged in. And it is a powerful, powerful feeling. And it is the feeling that people have that if there is hope, if they know that they will have a chance, everything is possible. They will not get wealthy. They will not, you know, they will not be able to get every dream that they have fulfilled. But at least they know that they will not, every time they put their head up, they will not get clobbered over the head with a sledgehammer. And that's what we see, the policies of privatization, the policies of the World Bank and the IMF, the policies that say to people, all you're good for is working in a sweatshop. That's what they do time and time again. And we hope that this dream and vision of a new world, that is being, you know, a small experiment of it is happening in Brazil and in Kenya and in a lot of communities around the world, Cuba, in all sorts of other places. People have a great deal of hope, and with hope, everything is possible, I believe, and we see that happening time and time again in Porto Alegre and in other places where people are coming together under the banner of another world is possible to organize and to learn from each other.